Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, welcome to another Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and before we start tonight's show, I've just got a quick announcement to make. You may have noticed already that Little Atoms is involved in a new branch of the Skeptics in the Pub movement, that's Soho Skeptics. And we've got a fantastic event coming up on the 5th of December. Ben Goldacre will be talking about his book Bad Pharma. The tickets are £5 and there's still some available. So the best way to find out about the event and where it is, because it's not in our usual venue, is by taking a look at the website sohoskeptics.com. And so on with tonight's show. My guest tonight is the psychologist Jesse Baring. Jesse Baring is a regular contributor to Scientific American and Slate, and his writing has also been featured in many other sources, including New York Magazine, The Guardian and The New Republic. Jesse is the former director of the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Queen's University Belfast and began his career as a psychology professor at the University of Arkansas. He currently lives in Ithaca, New York, and is the author of Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? And The God Instinct, The Psychology of Souls, Destiny and the Meaning of Life, which is what we talk about in this interview. So I'm talking to Jesse Baring. Jesse, welcome to Little Atoms.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
We're going to be talking about your book, The God Instinct, The Psychology of Souls, Destiny and the Meaning of Life. So first of all, well, let's talk about this idea of God. It seems to be something that's been with most civilizations. There always seems to be this idea there with us.
Right. So not every society, of course, or culture across the world would refer to it as God, of course. But my argument in the book is that human beings, no matter what particular religious organization you happen to be associated with, all have this intuitive sense of a supernatural presence that is responsible for significant events in their lives, that is communicating messages to them, that is responding to some type of moral transgression. And I know atheists typically hear that type of argument and they immediately bristle because they feel that that doesn't apply to them. But I think I've made the case in the book that even if you feel that way strongly, ideologically, and you identify quite passionately as an atheist, if you look deeply enough and if you have a close inspection of the psychological literature, you'll find that even as an atheist, you are susceptible to these same types of biases. So you asked about the universality of God. And I think, you know, God is shorthand for this agency, but I don't want to lose people potentially because of the term itself. I think that what's important to note is that we're referring to an abstract mind or presence that is communicating with us or that's interested in our behaviors in some way. And it could be simply a dead relative. Or spirit, or ghost.
As we go on, we'll sort of talk about some ways in which this belief system sort of manifests itself in us. But it's interesting you say that as an atheist sometimes bristle at this idea, because the book is not saying there's this thing in the back of our mind that proves God exists. It's saying this is where this belief comes from. And I have spoken to a couple of friends since I've read the book about this. And you're right, people do seem to say, well, no, I'm an atheist. I definitely don't believe that. But then when you do suggest that there are other sort of smaller ways in which that might happen, I think people do come around to the idea, yeah.
Right. So I should perhaps say at the very beginning that I'm an atheist, and I wrote this from an atheistic psychological perspective. I'm simply trying to understand why the mind is so disposed to thinking in these terms. And the vast majority of the human population is comprised of believers.
Let's set up the background, I guess, to why human beings are different to other animals in this respect. And you raise the concept, first of all, there's a broader term for this, but I want to talk specifically about Daniel Dennett's idea of the intentional stance. So tell us what that means, first of all.
Well, the intentional stance is basically the knee-jerk assumption that there are agents in the natural world that have unobservable psychological states. They do things for reasons. And I became interested in this line of investigation as a graduate student because I started my work in the bayous of Louisiana working with chimpanzees, studying chimpanzee social cognition at a comparative psychologist laboratory, but his name is Daniel Povinelli. And the big question that Povinelli's lab was focusing on was whether chimpanzees had this ability to reason about unobservable mental states. Do they have what we call now a theory of mind? And a theory of mind, there are some meaningful differences between an intentional stance and a theory of mind, but for all intents and purposes, it is the same thing. It's this ability to think about what we can't see, these sort of abstract causal properties. And in this sense, we're talking about mental states. And it occurred to me, I suppose, working with chimpanzees, that what might be sort of at the heart of our tendency to think about God and things like the afterlife and about destiny is all rooted in this theory of mind capacity. Because if we think about God, we have to think about God's mind. What is God, basically, but a mind that does things for reasons, that has emotions, that gets upset when we violate some sort of social rule, that is trying to give us messages in manipulating aspects of our natural world and giving us signs and so on. To think in that fashion requires a theory of mind. And if theory of mind is something that's fundamentally unique to human beings, then so too would the concept of God be.
We'll come back to Povinelli in a bit, because I want to look at the controversy that he's involved in. But let's talk about, first of all, like where we first started to think about this idea, this concept of the theory of mind, where it came from and how we first became to decide this was something that was unique to human beings.
Well, the original research began in the late 1970s with Primack and Woodruff studies. And actually, it goes back even before that to the psychologist. He's the British psychologist, Nicholas Humphrey, who was doing field research with gorillas, with Diane Fossey, actually. Mm-hmm. And he says that it occurred to him in the middle of the forest that what might make him different from the gorillas that he was looking at in their natural ecology was that he was wondering what it was like to be a gorilla, but he doubted that the gorillas were wondering what it's like to be a human being. And it occurred to him, he said spontaneously, that this could be sort of the big thing that differentiated human beings from other species, this ability or this tendency to be natural psychologists, to constantly get into the heads of other people and other organisms, to put ourselves into other shoes. So I suppose it all started with Nicholas Humphrey's research, and that, I believe, was back in the late 60s or early 70s. Then it kind of caught on in the comparative psychology labs, and people began to, you know, put this question under the microscope. Under controlled conditions, do other species have the ability to reason about other minds? Or do they have the ability to the same degree that human beings do?
Let's talk then about some of the experiments that were done to test that. There are some great experiments that have been done on chimpanzees to see whether or not they can detect another being might have a mind of its own.
The classic experiment was done by Daniel Povinelli. Well, I mean, there are several classic experiments, but the one I think that's best known is perhaps the study where a chimpanzee that had been used for other types of psychological experiments. He had a group of seven chimpanzees that were trained for behavioral studies. And they had this routine where they would come into the lab space and they were partitioned off from the human experimenter by a plexiglass partition or a wall. And in the wall, there were holes that the chimp could reach through to one side or the other. Anyway, the critical manipulation in the theory of mind studies, the original theory of mind studies in Povinelli's lab, involved a chimpanzee coming in first and being trained that every time it wanted to treat, it would simply reach through this hole or one of two experimenters, and whoever the chimpanzee reached out to would be the one that retrieved the food reward, you know, something like a cracker or a cookie or a biscuit or something like that. You guys say biscuits, don't you? But they reached the hole, they would give it to that person would give it to the chimpanzee. And the chimpanzee sort of understood that basic rule, and they were trained that way. But then the chimpanzee would come in, and it would encounter the same two experimenters, but this time one of the experimenters would have his or her vision obscured in some way. So he would have a blindfold over his eyes, or his back would be turned to the chimpanzee, or his eyes would simply be closed, or a bucket over his head, something like that. And Povinelli, his hypothesis was that while the chimpanzees understood seeing as a psychological state, they should reach toward the person didn't have his or her vision obscured to give them their food reward. And they didn't do that. They simply reached indiscriminately toward either the seeing experimenter or the non-seeing experimenter. And Povinelli's conclusion was that, well, they obviously don't have a theory of mind then.
I mentioned that conclusion is controversial, for want of a better word. And obviously, all of this time, the sort of Diane Fosses and the Jane Goodalls have been experimenting on the great apes. And there's this idea that great apes have become closer and closer to humans, and we talk about their rights. There's almost something non-PC nowadays about suggesting that they're not as close to us as we like to think.
Right. And I think it is a very sensitive topic. And I think that people understand these types of data to mean that chimpanzees are not as intelligent as human beings or not as good as human beings or something along those types of scala naturae lines. But it's not like that. It's simply an appreciation of evolutionary biological diversity. If we have this capacity and chimpanzees don't. It says nothing about us being better than them or something along those lines. It just simply reflects a meaningful neurologically based difference that would have risen over the past 2 to 3.5 million years or so that we last shared a common ancestor.
In fact, to be honest, to suggest that we might be better than them because of that actually hints at what we're going to be talking about later in this book, because it almost suggests that there's a point to us having that intelligence.
Yeah, but I would never use the expression that we are better than any other species, because I think that what, again, is key is the fact that we simply are different. We had a different set of adaptive challenges, largely as a consequence of evolving this theory of mind, which actually wasn't such a good thing in every sense of the term.
Well, we'll talk about why it wasn't necessarily a good thing as we go on. But first of all, let's talk about why it might be a good thing. So what sort of advantages would that have bestowed on us to evolve a theory of mind?
All sorts of things. And I think probably the most important one, or the most critical factor in terms of our success as a species and just simply dominating geographically and at a population level, is that it facilitated or allowed for the advent of cultural and technological advances. Because now that we had a theory of mind, we could take into consideration the fact that others didn't have the knowledge that we had. So we could deliberately teach them. We could share information intentionally with them that we knew that they didn't have. And according to the anthropologist Michael Tomasello, who also does research with chimpanzees, this was so important because it provided this scaffolding allowing for technological advances. Unlike chimpanzees, we didn't have to reinvent the wheel with every generation. Human beings, each successive generation could build successively on the accomplishments, the technological developments of the generation that came before. So again, we've got this sort of scaffolding effect. And language, of course. I mean, language is part of the picture as well. With the advent of theory of mind, now we had symbolic or abstract vocalizations that actually refer to things in the natural world or to abstract psychological states that we understood that other people had the same appreciation of.
Let's talk then about the concept that this theory of mind may have in some ways been overdeveloped in human beings then. What have the consequences of that been?
Well, in The God Stinked, I argue that these were great things, of course, having culture and language and being able to share our private experiences and being able to empathize with others and so on, and to predict and explain people's behaviors. But it came with a dark side or a bad side as well. And that was basically the problem of gossip. It became incredibly useful to gather information socially about those that we interacted with on a daily basis, those in our relatively circumscribed society in the deep ancestral past, you know, to know that a particular male had some problems with his inhibitory skills and was prone to abusing physically children is very strategic knowledge to have. If you're a woman, you don't want to necessarily have children with that person, if that's the case. So we would be very attentive to information about others, this sort of juicy, strategic, social gossip. And we would always be on the lookout for gathering information. And we know from evolutionary psychological research that a significant portion of human conversation is basically just gossip. It's about other people, whether it's true or not. Now, the problem came along with the fact that not only were we gathering information using language about other people, but people were gathering information about us. So we had to be very careful and deliberate about what we were doing in the presence of others, because everything we did was potentially for the gossip mill. So that's the chief adaptive problem that I articulate or lay out in the book, is that all of a sudden now we had to worry about not what we did simply in the presence of one person that would physically retaliate against us by hitting us, but if it was just simply observed by one person, the fact that we did it or had some predisposition could grasshopper from mind to mind to mind to mind to absent third parties.
Let's just park that concept of gossip for a moment then, because that's going to come back when we get to the central thesis of the book. But let's talk about, you know, the idea of anthropomorphism as well, and this comes out of the overdevelopment of a theory of mind and the fact we're likely to suggest agency to inanimate objects or animals or, you know, or things that just simply don't have it.
Right. So for a very long time, there was one of the dominant theoretical perspectives in this field, which is the broad field, is called the cognitive science of religion, mm-hmm. is related to anthropomorphism. It's the idea that we are so hypersensitive to the possibility that there are dangerous agents in the environment, whether it's other people or potentially predatory animals that would pose problems as well. When we are interacting in our natural environment, we are hypervigilant or alert to the possibility that there are other intentional agents around us. And an argument that has been circulating in the literature for quite some time is called the hyperactive agency detection device model, or HAD, the acronym. And it basically means that when you're out in the middle of the forest, for example, and there's a lot of ambiguity in terms of your surroundings, if you hear a branch fall to the ground, or you step on something that seems to move of an agency of its own, your intuitive or automatic assumption is that there's a potential danger there. There's another mind there that is posing some risk to you. So we anthropomorphize the natural world in that sense, and we infuse it with all sorts of things that ultimately would turn into supernatural agents. Doesn't require a lot of reasoning about psychological properties of these agents. It just simply assumes that they have intentions, and their intentions typically are nefarious, or they're geared to threaten you. So that was a model that was floating around in the literature for a very long time. And I think it's a little bit simplistic, actually. I think it's more complicated than that.
I sort of said at the beginning of the program, I'd had this conversation with a couple of friends who are atheists who didn't necessarily recognize that they would be sort of prey to this type of thinking. And I thought there was a great illustration in the book about the way that anthropomorphism affects us. And you talk about the old film, The Red Balloon, and how it's basically central to us being able to understand that film. Tell us that little story.
Well, I use in the book several illustrations of cases where, despite the fact that we don't believe that there's a God, or we don't believe that there's a mind behind the curtains, we still operate or think in that way in any number of ways. And I think one analogy, perhaps, are stories like The Red Balloon, where we get emotionally suckered into the plot. That this balloon is altruistic, and it has a friendship with the little boy that he's following around the streets of old Paris, and it's difficult for me even now to watch it without crying when the balloon gets popped by, you know, these bullies, these children that are throwing rocks at it. I know that the balloon isn't an actual subjectively experiencing organism, but our minds simply go there. And I also use the example in the book of how when my mother died. I mean, I've been an atheist for as long as I can remember, but when my mother died when I was 24 years old, the next morning, wind chimes outside of her bedroom window started to make sounds. And although I didn't believe this was my mother talking to me, telling me that she was okay and she had made it to the other side, nevertheless, this was my first intuition, or my sort of knee-jerk assumption that, oh, there's mom telling me that she's okay. You know, she's giving me a message telling me that she's made it through, something ridiculous like that. I didn't believe it, but I experienced it. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at with this book, differentiating atheism from an explicit ideological belief system that has sociopolitical consequences to atheism as atheism being violated by these basic mechanics of the way cognition works.
I mean, you're talking about something that's similar to, you know, this idea of pattern recognition, I guess, and this idea that, you know, it's better to mistake a tree for a tiger than it is the other way around in an evolutionary sense.
It's the type one error type of argument, or the fact that we are vulnerable to these cognitive illusions, and the fact that we are so vulnerable is adaptive in itself.
So let's talk then about how this cognitive illusion, what's the point of a belief in God then brings to that?
So it all goes back to this adaptive problem of gossip. That, again, is unique to our species. And I just want to sort of reinforce that point that what makes us different, our social behaviors different than any other species, is the fact that what we do in the presence of a single other pair of eyes can be communicated literally in terms of what happened to third parties that weren't present. Those third parties are the ones that could actually punish us, not the person or the animal that saw us doing whatever it is that we've done. So inhibition would have been critical here. It didn't matter the status of the person that saw us doing what we were doing. It simply mattered that they had a theory of mind and they had a mouth that could use language and communicate that information to others that could punish us. So with that adaptive problem, it would have been highly adaptive to be under the impression or operating under the illusion that there was some type of grand pair of eyes, this sort of panopticon, you might call it, this agent that knew what we were doing at any given time. And not only simply knew and collected information about what we were doing, but could respond in a manner that was in line with our social ecology. So if we transgressed in some significant fashion, we might not get punished if we didn't get seen by some other person, but we could be punished by getting cancer. Well, they wouldn't have called it cancer, but getting physically ill or having some problems with our relationships or losing a child to a predator or, you know, our crops failing, something along those lines, some symbolic manifestation of misfortune that would have been seen as the consequence of our moral transgression that was caused by this disgruntled supernatural agent. And if we feared that, we feared it strongly enough, it would thwart our selfish decision-making and would have facilitated more inhibition. And if we did inhibit our social behaviors, then the likelihood of us being detected by actual people and being punished by actual group members would have been significantly reduced. And therefore, there's the adaptive solution to the problem of gossip.
Broadening it out from the idea that we envisage like a sort of punitive man in the sky looking at us and keeping us on the straight and narrow, we also see signs of God's handiwork in, well, all around the world. And we sort of attribute reason to things that happen, like natural disasters and things like that.
Yeah, so one situation where these types of attributions to God really sort of crops up is when we've got natural disasters. And I think that what this gets at is it's similar to what happens when we're interacting with other people and we're trying to figure out why other people are doing something that they've done that violates our expectation. The cognitive developmentalist Jerome Bruner had this term, conversational implicature, to refer to the fact that when we search for meaning with other people, specifically when they deviate from some sort of social script or violate our expectations about what they're going to do. So, Neil, if all of a sudden you started crying on the other end of the line right now, that would be pretty unusual. Or I immediately start guessing about what's happening to you. What, some sort of emotional problem, or did something happening that I can't see on the other end of the line? I would try to basically decipher the meaning of your crying response. And something similar to that happens with natural disasters, I believe, when things go unexpected, like a tsunami, for instance, or some terrible hurricane, or, you know, getting just at a personal level, somebody in your family getting sick, and fatally so. That's when we really start asking this question, why, to really get into the head of God.
Moving on from that idea then of God as the sort of the celestial police, but what also generally goes along with a religious belief is ideas of destiny and fate and the idea of an afterlife.
Right.
So how are those two things related?
Well, yes, and I should stress that God isn't, or supernatural agents, again, more generally, mm-hmm. it's not always just some sort of moral arbiter that punishes us for our misdeeds. I think what's equally important in the dynamic is this sense that God is really on our side and wants what's best for us. And we're in a relationship with him or her or whatever, in a way that we want to do things that we think are desirable from its perspective. So the sense that we have a destiny, that everything will work out in the end for us, that God or whatever sort of wants us to achieve our full potential in life, I think lines up with this relationship model, that we have a contract of sorts with this figure. And God will reward us if we adhere to that social contract. This is what a lot of religious people believe anyway, and will punish us if we deviate from it. But ultimately, the dominant sense is that this figure is on our side.
So there's also this idea of the soul and the idea of the continuance of some form of life after death. And another reason that's often given for a continual belief in a supernatural being is simply a fear of death, and people don't want to believe that there'll be nothing left of them after they expire. So how do you think this is related to the idea that, you know, that we have a theory of mind?
Right, and I'll answer that question in just a moment, but I wanted to go back to the destiny question because I don't think I had answered it directly. I wanted to. So when we think about destiny, we really are thinking about some type of pre-authored narrative, something that is supposed to happen to us. And whenever we think about some storyline in that fashion, we have to ask ourselves, well, who exactly is the author that would have laid out the story in this particular way? So to reason about destiny and fate and these types of teleological types of concepts doesn't always line up perfectly with a belief in God. But if you look at it, it really does assume that there's a mind. And this issue really only makes itself transparent when things don't happen exactly the way that we envision. In the book, I give the example of how when stories are just sort of severed midstream, and maybe the best example is The Sopranos final episode where, they're in this diner and they're sitting around the table gathering a family and chit-chatting, and all of a sudden things go black. There's no resolution to the story. We don't find out exactly what happened to Tony Soprano. We don't know if he got shot, if he had a heart attack, whether he had a stroke. We don't know what happened. And we're sort of frantically looking for meaning or what the script writer actually was trying to tell us as an audience. And I think something happens like that with people, too. If you can imagine, and this is really what death is. You know, it's all of a sudden we drop dead midstream. There's no conclusion to our story where everything all of a sudden makes sense.
Just to finish off, one final question. Looking back on the idea of it being evolutionarily to our advantage to protect our reputation, so there's this thing that keeps us basically on the straight and narrow. But of course, you know, people have always been bad. People have always done things to damage their reputation. So, I mean, are you talking really about the very, very beginning of human beings first coming together as a society, or do you still think it constantly has some effect over the entire story of human beings?
I think it has. I think the effect is one for the entire story of human beings, even up to the present. You know, there would have been cases where extraordinary violence, for instance, or a reputation as being just a complete asshole would have actually facilitated reproductive success. I'm not denying that fact.
Yeah, people like bastards.
I think by and large, it's more than just simply a caveat that engaging in social transgressions, whatever those transgressions are, and I do think there are parameters in terms of the severity of misdeeds that would be determined by the particular culture that we live in, and those are defined and given shape. But all cultures have certain behaviors that are just absolutely unforgivable in terms of reentering society without some type of stigma. And I think just one misstep, one critical misstep, rape, murder, child abuse, these types of things would have been enough to completely ruin an individual's reproductive success through some type of communal punishment. And that's enough pressure there. Just simply the possibility that one misstep would have ended it all would have put tremendous pressure on the importance of inhibition. And this cognitive illusion of being watched would have simply been part and parcel with that.
And so I guess you could say that we've sort of socialized that reputational damage with things like, you know, the law and the penal system.
Yes, and I make the argument in the book that we've largely outgrown this cognitive illusion of God. We don't need God anymore. I mean, unfortunately, this is just the way that our brains work now. We still have the residue of God in our cognitive systems. But now we also have alongside that these complementary social monitoring mechanisms like hidden cameras, fingerprint analysis, going through, you know, metal detectors in the airports, social security numbers. All of these things are designed to keep people in behavioral check, social check. I don't think we need God as much as we used to, but obviously it's still there. I think just simply an artifact of our neurological systems, and it's a shadow that is inspired by human cognition.
There's no denying that. So I've been talking to Jesse Baring, and we've been talking about his book, The God Instinct, The Psychology of Souls, Destiny, and the Meaning of Life. Jesse, thanks so much for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thanks, Neil.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.